and gentlemen, welcome wrestling fans worldwide to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I'm the great Ryan Last. It's my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud takes us down that road of wrestling history, sharing his personal tales and anecdotes, and today maybe some business strategy and much, much more. But without any further ado, the man of the hour, the leader of the Studcast, the Tennessee Stud himself, Ron Fuller. And Ron, we've been building up to this. You're finally getting ready to leave Florida. How you doing today?
I'm doing great, man. I'm always feeling good when it's time to saddle up. So I'm ready to roll, my man. And we're getting into really new territory here, literally. And going to change my life. And this episode is going to be one that'll start it in that direction. And I'm really looking forward to this, as I think a lot of fans have been out there for a long time.
Well, before we get there, Ron, you know, we want to thank everyone for the tremendous response we've received for the recent series that we've done on Florida in 1974, as well as we want to thank all the patrons of the Studcast who have been sharing their comments and reviews and really spreading the word about the latest Super Studcast, the two-part Super Studcast number 13 on the 1979 Knoxville Wrestling War. The fans, Ron, it seems that they just can't get enough of hearing about this historic event that changed things forever with Southeastern Wrestling, as well as Knoxville wrestling history. Want to remind everyone, the 3-hour-plus history lesson, well worth the $2.99. Let me repeat that. It's only $2.99 at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. But Ron, as we get things going with the show, we want to remind everyone we are now leaving Florida. We've spent so much time, so many years covering you in Florida, and we are now getting to that point where after 4 years of learning everything you would need to know to do your own thing, to have your own wrestling company, you are about to do that. At the age of 26, you're about to become one of the youngest promoters of all time, maybe the single youngest promoter and owner of a wrestling promotion in wrestling history. And everyone's been waiting to hear this. Everyone's been waiting to hear this story about how you made that difficult decision to either follow the road towards a possible world championship. Things seem to be heading that way in some respects, especially with all the St. Louis bookings. Or do you settle down one place, build your own territory, your own company, and do things your own way? So Ron, let me let you take it from there after my long intro. We are finishing up your time in Florida, but we're not completely out of Florida just yet.
No, not completely as of yet. And we'll probably go back to it a little bit within the next couple of episodes, because I'll be changing territories, and there's a lot involved in that too as well. But this is basically where my life is going to change, and I'm definitely at a crossroads in it. I've been staying almost 4 years in one territory, and that's most unusual. Your popularity is normally going to decline after that many years in the same territory. And I'm starting to see a little bit of that because I have been there for 4 years. It's pretty hard to stay in a territory for 4 years and maintain that that push and that enthusiasm from the fans. It's going to wane on you a little bit as the years go by. My St. Louis dates and all its great exposure has kind of dwindled since Watts came and started booking in early part of 1974. And he calls up Sam and says, he really would like to keep me in Florida and use as many options as he can with me. And and could Sam use me less? And Sam agrees to it because Sam realizes that's where I live and it's my home. And Sam's the type of guy that he's all for the wrestler, and kind of like I was as a promoter. I'm all for whatever's going to be best for the guy. And that was probably the best spot for me at this point. And Sam agrees with him that, yeah, I won't book him here in 74, and I'll let you keep him in Florida and do with him what you need to do. And he's been using me well. Bill's used me great in 1974. But as we go into the late part of the summer in 74, it's becoming apparent to me that there's still all this new talent continuing to come. And at some point, it's just going to be my turn to leave Florida. I'm going to get that notice that I was probably expecting a couple of years earlier. And I've also noticed that I start getting on Tuesday nights when I really get a feel for what's going on. I start getting booked on Tuesday nights in Fort Myers again, instead of that Tampa shot on Tuesdays. And that was the sign for me when I first came in. I got to work Tampa about two times, and then I wasn't in Tampa for 6 or 8 months. I was a Fort Myers guy, and I start going back to that Fort Myers guy. And that's not a good sign. The way I looked at it, that was not a good sign for my future there in Florida. I've had a great run there, a fantastic run. It's all been big money with Watts in 74. As we've all talked about with Dusty turning babyface, it's been a tremendous, tremendous time for me to be there. And I was really happy to have spent that early part of 74 all the way up to the fall of 74, basically making that big bread, because there was certainly some of the biggest bread that probably wrestlers ever made in that time frame anywhere in the country and anywhere in the world for that matter.
Ron, you visited lots of different places, but you always had Florida as your home. When you start thinking about different places to potentially go to, because you realize going from Tampa to Fort Myers is a big step down for you, are you thinking of places you'd like to go? Where were the places that you would want to go at that period of time?
Well, there's a lot of great territories and a lot of them that I knew about that I hadn't been to. And I'd always wondered about what it would be like to work there. And one of them was Jim Crockett Senior territory. This is before Junior gets involved and his boys get to where they're taking over the business. The Carolinas, tremendous territory. And I kind of regret that, you know, I never got to work in the Carolinas. I don't think I ever worked for Jim Crockett, which is just pretty amazing because I was so close to him. And I knew he was probably familiar with who I was and what kind of talent I was. I could always look at going back to Nashville. I'd never actually worked Nashville. I'd never worked the actual whole Tennessee territory as my brother had and as Jimmy had and Roy Lee Welch and Jackie Welch, my cousins, they had all worked out of Nashville before, and I never worked out of Nashville in the history of my time in the business either, which was that was truly amazing. Worked Memphis a whole lot for Jarrett, but I never worked Nashville ever, not a single match in Nashville. Pretty amazing that I'm right there between, it's right center, basically between Knoxville and Memphis. St. Louis, obviously, I've worked St. Louis, and I would really probably consider Geigel's Kansas City territory, because of my relationship with Sam. I know I would have gotten pushed in Geigel's territory. The Funks, I had a great relationship with Terry Ann Jr., both of them, and I always thought about going out west and working. That might have been the one territory I really would have liked to have worked, is Amarillo for the Funks. I could have gone back to Georgia, obviously. Barnett's there at this point, and Barnett and I already have a relationship, and it would have been a good spot for me to go to, or I could have even looked at the Fields Brothers, Gulf Coast Territory. Their business was down. I know about that time frame there that Bobby Shane, a couple of years previously, probably around 72, had come through that Gulf Coast Territory and lit it up. He did a little booking for him. He really got over for him. I think I probably could have gone to Gulf Coast Territory in 1974 and been a major star. They would have probably made a booker out of me. But, you know, as history has it, I'm going there anyway, 5 years down the road. So I'm going in as an owner rather than going in as a wrestler. So I guess the good thing about all this was the fact that I'd made a great name for myself in that first 4 years in the sport. And I had a lot more opportunities than other guys that had just 4 years experience. I was in a position because of what had happened for me in St. Louis to pretty much be a valuable wrestler and work on top in any territory I would have wanted to go to.
Ron, it was about a year earlier where you started to get those feelings where you weren't very happy and you started looking at other avenues outside of wrestling that you can make a living in. And, of course, Bill Watts got you back into wrestling. At this period of time when you're starting to feel this way, what are you feeling? Are you feeling stressed? Are you feeling anxious? Are you not so worried? And how did it compare to the feelings you had a year earlier?
Well, it's different than at this point, I realized that wrestling is it for me. And a year earlier, I wasn't really sure that I was in the right business. But I really, by the fall of 74, I really know that wrestling is where I want to spend the rest of my life. It's just a matter of where that spot is going to be. And when you're a wrestler, you don't stay places. You go places, and you're lucky if you get to stay there a year, much less 4 years, as I did in Florida. So you've got to expect, if you're just going to be a wrestler the rest of your life, you're going to be moving, and you're going to work a lot of different territories, and you're going to see a lot of the country. And so it was, for me, I'd worked there for a long, long time in Florida and had great success. But I realized that I got to make a change. And I'm not really not focused at all on being a promoter. I'm focused on being a wrestler. And when I give a notice here or when I get a notice here, I'm going to be going into another territory and see what I can accomplish there. So what happens for me is I worked Tampa on September the 10th, 1974, and I noticed a week in advance. I get my dates a week in advance, and I noticed I'm not on TV on that Wednesday after the Tuesday night in Tampa, and I know I wasn't booked again until Monday, the 16th of September in Orlando. I had about 5 days to do something, and so. I decided to spend some quality time with my family, and I booked a 4-day vacation in the Smoky Mountains up close to Knoxville. And my wife and two young sons, we fly into Knoxville on Wednesday, September 11th, 1974, rent a car. We head out of the airport for the Smoky Mountains National Park in Gatlinburg, Tennessee. We stay up in that Gatlinburg area for the first couple of days we're there. And it's the perfect spot to get away. It was so beautiful up there that I just fell in love with it. The serenity and the hospitality of that part of the country is just remarkable. Those people are so nice up there. And when you get up in those mountains, it seems like everything, your problems and your thoughts, it's all just, it disappears. And you just sit back and relax. They've got a lot of those streams that you can sit by the stream. So many sights you can see, so many things you can do while you're there. So we visit, a lot of the tourist spots. Obviously, we go to Klingman's Dome, which is one of the highest peaks in the Smokies. Beautiful place, tremendous view, a big drop off the side of a mountain. Just a fabulous place to go visit. And then we go down in the valley and we visit an area called Cage Cove, which is just a remarkably beautiful place that has deer. It has a drive that's probably 15 miles long. It's all one way. You can't go but one way. Everybody goes along there. You are going to see bears. You're going to see deer. You're going to see all types of different animals. And just the beauty of it all is just really, really amazing. So we enjoy ourselves up there in the mountains for a couple of days. And then on Saturday, before we're scheduled to fly back the next day on Sunday home to West Palm, We get a hotel room in Knoxville so that we can be pretty close to the airport because the flight's going to leave fairly early the next day. And so we make our way into Knoxville. We find ourselves a little hotel. And that's we're basically sitting ready to go home. And it's about 6 o'clock, 6:30 at night. And I've been doing a lot of thinking on the trip, you know, about the future as a family. You know, do we have a future as a family? I mean, when you're a wrestler and you're going everywhere like I was in the St. Louis days and doing the New York runs and all those things, you don't get to spend a lot of time with your family. So, you know, I was curious about the future that I have with my family. What did I have a future? And they had not seen a heck of a lot of me in the last 3 years. And my mind was focused on where I want to go next. I'm thinking about all those things. But, you know, funny as I was considering all this, I had not considered, like I said earlier, hadn't really considered being a wrestling promoter, owning my own company, starting a territory. I was more concerned about where's the right spot to take my family and the best spot I can find to continue my wrestling career. So about 6 o'clock, 6:30 that Saturday, we check in a little earlier. I turn on the TV in my room, and as fate would have it, guess what's on, man? Wrestling, obviously. And it's early in the show. Show's just kind of beginning, and I sit down in front of my TV there. And my wife and the two boys, they go outside to play. And I spend the next hour looking at my future. I don't really realize it at this point, but that hour, I'm looking right dead ahead into what my future is going to be all about. And I'm going to be polite as I can be about what I'm about to say, because I was really impressed with the beauty of the countryside up there. But I was just as unimpressed by this wrestling show that was on the television in front of me.
Before we get to that television show, Ron, let me ask you, how did you end up in Knoxville for the vacation? Who recommended it, or what made you decide to pick Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains as your vacation location?
Great question. I'd been there to Knoxville one time when I was a senior in high school in Atlanta. I went to visit the University of Tennessee. I had an opportunity for a scholarship there. And there was a Division II college just outside of town named Carson Newman that they were both interested. So they flew me up there, and I visited both those colleges. And I really loved the city. I just never forgot about the city, even though I went to Florida and spent a lot of time down there, went to the University of Miami, did all those things. I never really forgot how beautiful that part of the country was. So when I started thinking about a vacation, it just it kind of hit me that, you know, geez, why don't you go back up there around Knoxville? Maybe go and see that Smoky Mountain National Park, which is the most visited national park in America. So, you know, there's a lot going on there, and that's just kind of how I picked it out. So kind of strange, but I said, let's go to Knoxville.
How many guys or even promoters did you see during your career that actually got to take vacations?
Jeez. Wrestlers don't take a whole lot of vacations normally. Promoters, after you get to where you are a promoter and you're in a position where you're not having to wrestle every night, maybe you hired the right people and you have a company that's running smoothly and you don't have to even go to the smaller towns, and you end up with more time on your hands than you do as a wrestler. When you're a wrestler, they want to book you every night, and you kind of want to be on that card every night. That's the way you make your living. So, it was a little difficult to transition, but you know, it was really odd being there and it being such a beautiful place, and then getting this television program on the screen and start to cut this thing apart. I found myself watching this show and just trying to figure out how in the hell are they drawing anything with what they do here? It was really, really bad. I was accustomed, obviously, to being to seeing the best television production in the world in Tampa at that time frame, 1970s, early 1970s. Also, they have the best commentator, or one of the best alive, Gordon Solie. And what I saw during that hour was about as far from the Florida TV product as wrestling could get. The owner of the company was a former wrestler named John Cazana. And he'd taken over the production duties from his brother, George Cazana, in the 1950s, you know. And George, I don't know how George got there. I don't have the history of how George Cazana came to Knoxville. I wish I did have more of that history, but I don't have that. But George had been there since the 1930s. I had the opportunity to talk to John Cazana's grandson a couple of days ago, because I really wanted to get a feel for John Cazana. I had dealt with him and buying his territory, but I had dealt with him very little since buying his territory. And I really wanted to know a lot of things about him. John Cazana's show is called The Wide World of Wrestling. It's on a UHF station in Knoxville. It's on top of a little mountain there called Sharp's Ridge. It was impossible almost to get there in the wintertime. If it snowed, you could not drive up to that television station. You had to park at the bottom of the mountain, and you had to carry your wrestling bag up there yourself, because it was just too steep, and it was a dangerous drive to get up to this station. Because it's a UHF station, it has a very weak signal. It's not what you want to be on to have a great territory or to build a territory. You could run Knoxville with that station, but as far as being 30 miles outside the city, they didn't have a signal that got that far. So it was a good name of a show, Wide World of Wrestling. Great name, but it was very difficult to live up to that name. And he certainly was far from living up to that name of being a great wrestling program.
Ron, when you watch the Cazana wrestling program on this day, is that the first time you've seen Ron Wright since that week he worked in Florida?
There you go. I have not seen him since the chisel got broke out every night he was in Florida in 1971. Might have been 70, 71, and I had not seen him since, but it wasn't long. It didn't take me 15 minutes to realize that this is the Ron Wright show. I mean, you should have called it Ron Wright Wrestling, you know, because he was the guy. He was who you could tell everything was focused around Ron, and he was... He was hated by some fans, and he was loved by others. He was a strange individual, and what was happening in those shows, it kind of told you a lot about what Ron Wright had become in that eastern side of Tennessee. And he's a massive star for him. He was really kicking some butt for him. What was going on? It was totally different from what took place in Tampa every Wednesday morning at the old Snake Pit where TV was being recorded. Everything about that Florida show was formatted in advance. It was technically perfect. I mean, gosh, you couldn't. Every camera person, they were all on the ball. They were on top of things. The director had been there for many, many years. All of the things that make a great wrestling show were there in that building every Wednesday morning, and they really produced a high quality product. It was highly controlled as far as the interviews, per their content, whatever their content was, and the exact times for each interview. And that had to be the case because they were in a lot of Florida markets. This Knoxville show is wow. It's off the charts. It just goes rampant in all different directions. People talk whenever they want. They talk about particular towns. They talk about matches. I mean, you just can't do that. Back in this time frame, you were only supposed to have 8 minutes of actual commercials in your program. Those were the interview times. You could have 8 minutes worth of interviews, and you were bartering that show with different television stations. And if you went past that 8 minutes, they were on top of you. They really watched that. I was amazed. That's one of the first things I noticed is they're just talking about matches constantly, and there's no interview segments are 8 minutes long and 5 minutes long. You got Ron Wright out there talking about a match for 5 minutes. That just didn't happen in Florida TV, and it wasn't supposed to happen there. But I guess the television station didn't pay much attention to how much time they advertised with, or they would have had big problems. So their interviews and their content was just way, way off the charts. In Florida, obviously, the TV show was filled with tremendous wrestling. I mean, the quality of the talent was just amazing, and a lot of wrestling within those shows. Didn't see a lot of that in this show. And they enhanced that program in Florida so much by shooting that live footage in those big arenas and then coming back and post-producing them and putting those participants from those matches actually talking over the matches. Such impact they were having there to make themselves look good, to make their houses look big. It made the sport big. And obviously you're not going to get that on this show at this point. They had obviously the very best man they could behind the microphone in Gordon Sully. So having been a part of that for almost 4 years, it made me very critical of what I was watching on that Saturday afternoon, because it was way, way, way down the scale from where Florida was.
What else did you see on that show, Ron?
Well, I'd never seen anything like it before. It was, I was so accustomed to Florida wrestling shows. It probably had a lot to do with the station. Like I was saying, I don't think they paid any attention to the product. They didn't watch it themselves, or they would have said, hey, there's too much interviews. There's too many interviews, and there's too much talking in it, and there's not enough wrestling in it. And first thing I noticed right off the bat is, they had no format. It's like, God, they were just sending guys out there, and then there would be nobody out there, and then he would have to say, hey, can you get me so-and-so? And, I mean, it was like, compared to Florida, which was everything was timed, split. It was like you had to be there, and you knew when you were supposed to be in the ring and when you were supposed to leave the ring. It was pandemonium. In this television program, it was pandemonium reigned. It was like, gosh, man, what in the hell are they doing? Matches were changed seconds before they went on. And sometimes, they're even changed in progress. They would have another guy come in and go into the match, and then one guy gets hurt and they pull him out. It was just, I'd never seen anything like it. And the instructions were being relayed by the promoter. You could hear John Cazana talk to Big Jim Hess, who was the commentator, and say, he would be whispering in the background like he's trying to hide it. And he would go, we need to get that other match ready here. And I'm like, wait, you can't hear that kind of stuff. It's like, wow, what in the hell are they doing? Interviews were, like I said, just went on forever. And you could just come out and take over. I mean, Ron Wright would just come out, and you could tell there was no interview scheduled. He would just come out and sit down and take over the damn desk and start talking about a match or talking about whatever he wanted to talk about. And there was just no rhyme or reason to what they were doing. And a lot of the wrestlers, they had no business even calling themselves wrestlers. And they certainly couldn't make interviews. A lot of them had no skill whatsoever at talking. Camera angles were horrible. Sometimes the cameras weren't even focused. You could look at the picture and go, well, heck, why is it he isn't focused on the guy? And then the station's director, or the director of the show, was, I think he was more lost than the participants in the dang ring. I mean, it just like a mess. And one of the matches, he even chose the wrong camera for the finish and entirely missed the move that was the finish in the match. So, it was like, wow, you can't screw things up any worse than what they're doing. It struck me as the most, and then the worst of all. The thing that struck me the most was the unprofessionalism of the commentator. And, you know, and that's because after years of hearing Gordon Solie, man, describe in great detail and with extreme clarity the events that are going on in that ring, I was shocked to hear this commentator that they had. He just was off the charts bad.
Well, you've mentioned him a bit in the past on the show and, of course, on the Super Studcast. Let's talk a little bit about Big Jim Hess, Ron.
Yeah, so, you know, Big Jim, I think, wanted to be a wrestler. I think at some point in his life, he'd probably wanted to be a wrestler. And I believe that he, as the commentator of a program, if you don't have the demeanor of a Gordon Solie, that you're so professional about things, and I think he wanted to be a star on this show. He wanted to be the show. And you can't have your commentator, if you've got a wrestling program, your wrestlers are what people tune in for. Gordon was so great that people tuned in for Gordon. And that was most unusual with commentators. But in this guy's case, as far as I was concerned, he was ruining the product, and the product was pretty darn bad anyway. And I have a couple of brothers up in the Knoxville area, the Hill Boys, and they send me some audio from way back, you know, about the time frame that we're talking about. And I really appreciate them doing that for me. You know, they've got. Hess had an attitude, it put him far away from Gordon Solie as a commentator could get. And so, you know, I'm going to play a short clip. I'd like to play a short clip here if we could. A great example of a wrestling show with no format and with both parties at the desk running the show. And this is about a minute and a half long. It just shows how they had to change matches. Basically, I think what you're going to see here, you're going to hear here, is Ron Wright decides that I don't like the match I'm not scheduled in. I want to be scheduled in that match, and I'm taking so-and-so out and putting myself in. And it's like, you know, what kind of circus is this? And, you know, this is probably a pretty good give you a pretty good idea of what it's all about.
So they refused to get back in the ring with the Wright brothers. Donnie, he had to go home. He got his neck hurt a little bit last night and had an awful knot on his head and couldn't be here today. But I'll tell you something, old Ron Wright, he's got a few tricks in his hip pocket of his own. They've had me booked on TV here today again, this Mr. Rodriguez.
Yes, Silento Rodriguez.
Silento Rodriguez. They had Rocky Smith and DeVoy Brunson booked again the Garvins right today. I've had Mr. Smith back there talk to him for quite a while. I mean, as this wasn't a title match on TV today, Rocky Smith has agreed to step out of this tag match right here on TV today. Let me be DeVoy Brunson's partner, and I'll be right out here in the ring in the main event today.
Are you sure you can do that? I mean, this contract...
We're going to do it. Rocky Smith has agreed to come out here. I will not come out here in this next match and wrestle Rodriguez. Rocky Smith will be out here to wrestle him. When I get done, I'm going to wait on the Garvins to come out. I'm going to walk right up there in the ring, and me and DeVoy Brunson will try the Garvins again today. And I've got a little score that I want to settle with them right here in this ring today, because we was beat last night. And when Ron Wright goes down and gets beat, it kind of humiliates me a little, because there's not very many teams in this country that can beat the Wright brothers. And I assure you, if everybody of this keeps their TV turned on today and don't get it on something else and watch this main event coming up today, Ron Wright's going to do a little score setting with the Garvins and their loudmouth manager over there in the corner before 7:30 tonight, I assure you.
In other words, you're going to take Rocky Smith's place in the last match today.
I'm going to take Rocky Smith's place today because Anna says he don't care and Rocky Smith has agreed to do it. I'm going to be up there whooping on the Garvins when the tag match comes up, the last match on TV today, so I don't want nobody to run off. I've got some stuff in store for the men, regardless of what they say.
All right.
Thank you, Mr.
It's all right with me. I don't care.
See, that gives you a great idea of kind of what it was all about and how wild and crazy and off the wall this television production is. And I have another one here that I think it pretty well fits what's going on, too. Jim Hess here, and this one, I believe, is talking to Ron Wright. And if fans can, while they're listening to this, just imagine those that know Gordon Solie. I use Gordon as an example here. There are a lot of great commentators. But I cannot imagine Gordon Solie talking to any wrestler like Jim Hess is going to talk to to Ron Wright in this one. You know, he's gonna talk like he's a wrestler himself, and like he's gonna knock the hell out of Ron Wright. It's just pretty crazy about, and that's why I think I love this audio, because it will sure give fans an idea of what type of commentator they had on this wrestling program.
Okay. All right. See if you can find Ron and Don Wright for me, please, sir. We'll get him out here and I'll explain this thing to him. So I don't know what. Anyway,
you just hush a minute. And we want to see if you want to agree. All right. Here's what Kovacs and Rocky Smith want to do. They want to have an alley fight with you next Friday night. Everybody comes dressed in there. Will you shut up and let me finish? I said shut up and I'm going to finish. I said hush. And I mean hush for a change. All of you come dressed in your clothes. Of course, you wear your tights under there. You can either wear your street shoes or your boots. The one that gets his clothes stripped off of him first loses the match next Friday night. Do you agree to this? That's what Kovacs and Rocky Smith want.
So it was pretty obvious, I think, to anybody out there that this guy, you know, he either wants to be a wrestler or maybe he thinks he is a wrestler. And if he's not, he wants to be the star of the show. I couldn't believe that they would have a guy like that trying to run their wrestling program. And so, you know, because great commentators, they contribute to so much to the program, or at least they enhance it, at the very least, the wrestling product. This commentator, boy, in my opinion, he detracted from the product. And he obviously thought he should have been booked on the card. So by the end of this wrestling show, I'm wondering, what's this promoter drawing, you know, and how much better would his crowds be if he had a great TV show? And all of a sudden, I found myself asking questions like, what would I do to change this show? And who owns this town? And what kind of building do they have their matches in? And what would it take to buy the promoter out and run my own company? Within less than an hour, my thought process has changed entirely from being concerned about where I'm going to go to wrestle next to what if I could live in this beautiful place, control my own destiny by owning my own company, and be home with my family every night. Gosh, man, now that's a group of questions right there that just start the process of changing my whole life.
And we will see how many of those questions we answer on the other side of this break. We'll be back in just a moment, and we will continue our look at the decision-making process that leads the Tennessee Stud to become a promoter and an owner. But first, this word about Super Studcast number 13, the Knoxville Wrestling War of 1979, as well as the next Super Studcast, Super Studcast number 14, with Dr. D, David Schultz.
Thanks for joining us today on the very first Studcast that has to do with Ron's arrival in Tennessee. If you have not heard Super Studcast number 13, the Knoxville Wrestling War of 1979, it's now available at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. More than 3 hours of heartfelt memories from the stud about the worst time of his wrestling career. This is what Super Studcast are all about. And speaking of Super Studcast, don't miss the next one. Number 14, with the infamous Dr. D, David Schultz, talking about everything from his time with Ron in Southeastern, the slap of John Stossel at WWE, and Dr. D's Bounty Hunter days. Number 14 will be released on Tuesday, February 12th, with more than 3 hours of wrestling history and fantastic stories for only $2.99 at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Saddle up for education and laughs with the Tennessee Stud.
Well, there you hear it once again. Thank you to all the patrons of the Studcast. You can go to tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast and access Super Studcast number 13, parts 1 and 2, the 1979 Knoxville Wrestling War, and coming Tuesday, February 12th, Super Studcast number 14 with Dr. D, David Schultz. But we'll tell you more about that at the end of the program. Ron, let's get back to the story. You have just seen a wrestling show that has both horrified you and inspired you. Where are we going next with the story?
Well, you know, the next morning I'm leaving town, you know, but I spend a lot of time that night really thinking about what I've witnessed in the afternoon and starting to to get a real interest in speaking to somebody about this. I'm on a mission. You know, I kind of wake up the next morning saying, I want to find out who promotes this town, you know, and I go home and I start talking to my brother and both my cousins, Jimmy Golden and Roy Lee Welch, and my brother. They've all been wrestlers in Knoxville. They've been there since the early 70s, and all of them have wrestled in Knoxville, just like other Tennessee towns when you're in that Tennessee territory. And I wanted to find out from them what their experiences were like working in Knoxville. I asked all kinds of questions of all three of them. And I talked to my grandfather. I even called Roy, my grandfather, in Nashville. And ask about his arrangements. I find out John Kazana is the promoter there. And I ask about what's the arrangements there between you and John Kazana in Knoxville. And he explains to me a little bit about how they provide some talent and they get a booking fee and that type of stuff. And I start talking to the guys in the Florida crew. You know, I'm really on a mission here to get back up there and to maybe start my own thing. A lot of guys in that Florida crew have worked in Tennessee. Tennessee is a very popular territory. It has been for many, many years. And especially with young guys, a lot of them get their start in Nashville because they have a need for talent. Roy's got all this massive and huge territory, and he's got to supply talent to all the different entities all the way from the Gulf Coast, basically, to the state of Ohio is Roy's. And be able to do that with all those cities, you got to have a lot of wrestlers. So young guys come in there, they usually leave there with a kind of a bad opinion. I always loved the story Jack Briscoe used to tell me. And since we're talking about Florida here, I asked Jack one time, I said, did you ever work in Nashville? And he said, oh, yeah, Ron, I sure did. And I said, well, how did it go, man? How did you like it? And he said, I'll tell you what, Ron, he says, I drove in there in a Cadillac. And he said, I left there on a Greyhound bus. So it was not the best situation there sometimes working out of Nashville. But I got all types of feedback about Knoxville itself, that one particular city. And lots of guys I'd worked with in the Tennessee territory, and some of them had that Knoxville experience. So I found out how to get in touch with John Kazana. I call him up. I set up a meeting with him for the following Sunday. I arrived home on Sunday, the 15th, and the next Sunday, I'm going back to Knoxville exactly 1 week after arriving back home to sit down and talk to John Kazana and find out more about Knoxville.
You mentioned a lot of people that you spoke to about this idea and looking for information about Knoxville. You didn't mention your father. Why didn't you talk to your father about this?
Well, you know, my dad and I's relationship is a little strange. It's better back in that stage than it is before he sends me into Ohio and has me do some things that ends up costing me a lot of money. But I'm hesitant to talk to him about it because I don't know what his opinion is. And I'm afraid that he would probably nix my enthusiasm. So I stray away from talking to my dad. I stay pretty much with my cousins and with my brother and with some of the other boys. So I fly back to Knoxville and I get myself a hotel room downtown on that Sunday, September 22nd, 1974. And Kazana picks me up at my hotel, and just the two of us go out to his boat on the Tennessee River, and it's a dock that's located just below Knoxville, south of Knoxville. It's late September. The leaves are just starting to turn a little bit, and it's just as beautiful along the river there as it was in the mountains the week before up there in the Smokies. I had a most unusual boat. It was about 30 feet long. And it was pushed by a paddle wheel, just like a Mississippi River boat. I'd never seen that before on that size of boat. And on the inside, it was all done in this dark wood, and you could pilot it. You run this sucker from below deck or above the deck. It was beautifully made for river travel. And as we're getting to know each other, we untie from the dock there, and we make a short trip into Knoxville up that beautiful Tennessee River. We go past the University of Tennessee and this big old fantastic football stadium that sits right down there on the river and right into the heart of a town that's going to become my future. And it was quite a day. I spent quite a day with John Cazana there. A real experience for me, talking about something I never dreamed that I would be talking about, maybe potentially buying something and trying to build my own company.
Ron, what can you tell the listeners about John Cazana?
Well, I can tell them quite a few things about John. John Cazana was Greek. He was from his family from Greece, and they'd been in the country for quite a while. We talked about how he became a wrestler, and I found out a lot from him that day that I didn't know. I found out he was trained by Jim Londis, and that's another Greek, and another one of the best of all time, fabulous wrestler, Jim Londis. And to be trained by Jim Londis, you're going to be pretty darn good. John tells me that he wrestled partners pretty much early part of his career for a great length of time with another wrestler named George Zaharis. And John says he didn't have a very long career. I asked him, how long do you work? And he said, really only about 8 years. And I came back to Knoxville and settled down. But I want to talk about George Zaharis here for a little bit, because when he mentioned that name, I knew George Zaharis's, some of his history. And I was really amazed by the fact. And I think that's because they're both Greek. George Zaharis, Greek blood, too. So there was a, between Londis and Cazana and Zaharis, they had a lot of that Greek thing working with them. And they got along great, obviously. George Zaharis, just to give fans, and maybe not familiar with George Zaharis, he was born in Pueblo, Colorado. And he was known as the Crying Greek from Cripple Creek. I mean, that was a strange little thing. That area up there, I guess, is Cripple Creek. It must be an area around Pueblo, Colorado. And the funny thing about George Zaharis is not George. It's his wife, who was much more iconic as an American superstar than George Zaharis ever would be or was. George Zaharis married Mildred Babe Zaharis in St. Louis, Missouri in 1938. She is regarded as one of the greatest female athletes of all time. This lady won 10 major LPGA golf championships. She was an All-American basketball player. She won 2 gold medals and a silver medal in the 1932 Summer Olympics. And she is to this day the only track and field athlete, male or female, to win individual Olympic medals in a running event, the 80 meter hurdles, a throwing event, she threw the javelin in the Olympics, and a jumping event, she did the high jump. So she won gold medals in the running event and in the javelin, and ended up with a silver medal in the high jump. An absolutely amazing feat. I had never had any idea she was that good an athlete till I got to looking into her. But that's truly amazing. 3 totally different types of sports, and to be able to win medals and Olympic medals for those sports, that's just truly a phenomenal feat right there. So we come back to Knoxville, and Cazana comes back when he's ready to retire. He tells me, he comes back. His brother George is there, been there since the 30s. Now he's a wrestler some, and he's going to wrestle in Knoxville some for his brother. He basically takes over for his brother. I didn't ask him, you know, did you buy him out? How did you end up with it? I didn't think that was probably my business to be digging in like that to his business. But he became basically the recognized owner in Knoxville and sometime in the 1950s. I asked him when. He said it was in the 1950s. And he's in the television era here now. When you're in the 50s, you've got TV stations around. And once TV starts to develop and you can get on a television station, you're going to have some success with wrestling. I think they probably did better, my guess is, in the 50s and the 60s, maybe, than they did in the 70s, the early 70s. But John Kazana was a very likable guy, and thank goodness he was interested in selling, because he had been there for so many years. He had done it all. He had been the wrestler. He had been the promoter, and he was tired, and you know, and he was happy to hear that somebody was interested in maybe buying him out. So during the afternoon we spent together, we talked about all types of things that he had tried to accomplish. Since he was there from the 1950s, and such as being able to draw on the biggest building in the city, the Knoxville Coliseum. It had always eluded him, the fact that he could not make a success out of going into the biggest building in the city. And we talked about his only TV station, the fact that he's in one town. He doesn't have a territory. He doesn't think that way. He's just thinking that, well, I've got a TV station and I'm here in Knoxville, and that's all I want. We talked about his present building, the size of it. You know, I got a feel for what it was like and what he thought that the city might be able to accomplish in the future. Did he think he had taken it to where it could, the biggest it could possibly be? And you know, I'm thinking you know, that Scott, after watching his TV show, I don't know how you couldn't do better, much better on the television. If your television is much better, your chances are everything else is going to be much better. So finally, you know, after we have this long discussion, everything, we start discussing the crux of the matter here. You know, what does he want? What do you want for this market? You know, first thing out of his mouth, I about fell on the deck. You know, he said, I want $150,000 for it. My first impression was to tell him to take me back to the dock. You know, you know, sounded like a ridiculously high price. But I loved everything I had seen. I already had my mind made up, I think, you know, that this is something I could do, and that I could make that town worth maybe 10 times that amount of money if I did it right. And I really had a thought in my head. I was just really consumed with the fact that I'm ready for this, that I can do this. I've been doing it for other people for years now, and I wanted it. So I saw something and that he and his brother had never considered, and not just one city, but I saw a potential territory with a bigger television station, a bigger signal, able to run six shows a week, have matches in potentially four states, have more than one television station, be on television stations in other states. So I instantly began to negotiate the terms of the purchase. You know, I felt like, you know, I tried to pull him down from that 150. There's no way I can do that. So what I do is I try to negotiate with him on the basic of about the terms. You know, I'm obviously I'm not going to come up with $150,000, and very few people would pay somebody all up front for that. So I wanted to put a small amount down and make a small weekly payments to him. And he didn't much like the idea. He didn't want a small amount down. Obviously, he wants to get as much of his money as he can. But I brought to his attention the fact that he probably didn't think about that. I told him that if I failed to pay him, it might be after years of paying him that I failed to pay him, that he'd get his town back. So, you know, he thought about that. I could see it in his face. You know, that rang bells with him. You know, in other words, I might get $100,000 and then I get my town back. So we finally settled before we left the boat that day on giving him $25,000 down and paying him $500 a week for 5 years.
Did he tell you where he came up with the $150,000 number from?
No. You know, and gosh, man, you know. And
I mean, what could Knoxville have done for a year before Southeastern? What do you think Knoxville realistically could have done for an entire year?
You mean gross business? Or
yeah.
What his profit? I would have guessed his profit maybe he might make $30,000. He might do $30,000 profit. And then you figure in 5 years' time, you're going to be, if you make the $30,000, you're going to, it's worth $150,000. You're going to pay it back, put it in it as an investment. But I kept thinking about what it could be worth. Not what he was asking me. And boy, I got a lot of crap, Brian, from guys, wrestlers, and my dad and Eddie and promoters who just like, wow, you paid what for Knoxville? You know, and it took me a couple of years to prove to everybody that, wow, the kid was pretty smart, man. He actually got himself a hell of a damn territory, from buying one town.
$25,000 was a lot of money in 1974. How much of that money did you already have?
Well, I'm sorry to say, man, not nearly enough. the purchase of Knoxville was certainly very much in jeopardy when it came to that $25,000. And that might be a good place to stop right there, you know, because, that's a great story in itself.
I'll tell you what, that's where we will leave it because we are getting close to the end of the program, Ron. So as we wrap things up, want to remind everyone you can become friends with the Tennessee Stud on Facebook. The page, Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. Just like that page and instantly you are friends with Ron Fuller. You can also follow the Tennessee Stud on Instagram and Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last, and you can listen to me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite wrestling podcasts. Be sure and get Super Studcast number 13 today. Listen as the Tennessee Stud breaks down the 1979 Knoxville Wrestling War as only a territory owner could do it. All patrons that have listened to this emotional journey can ask questions about the Knoxville Wrestling War on posts that will be both on Facebook, on the Tennessee Stud's Facebook page, as well as on patreon.com/studcast. So stay tuned for that beginning on Thursday, February 7th. And again, you can get the Super Studcast at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. And the post on Facebook will be available at Ron Fuller Welch or Ron Fuller the Tennessee Stud, the two different pages. Don't forget also, Super Studcast number 14 with Dr. D. David Schultz will be released next Tuesday on February 12th. These two longtime friends, of course, the Tennessee Stud and Dr. D, former tag team partners, will discuss Southeastern history, wrestling riots they experienced together, the slap of John Stossel, the slap heard around the world, and David Schultz's Bounty Hunter days, and much, much more. Once again, Super Studcast number 14 debuts on Tuesday, February 12th, and you can get all episodes of the Super Studcast, all additional 3 hours, plus each and every month at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Ron, where are we going next week on the Studcast?
Well, obviously, we're going to look for money. We're going to go on a search for bread, and we'll find out where I'm going to get the money to make the down payment and how I did it to begin this, you know, how I'm going to begin this long, difficult journey to make a success out of just one city on the eastern side of Tennessee. It's, I think fans are going to be surprised with the answer to this one.
Ron Fuller Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I'm the Great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.